The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
At a little after 8:30 a.m. on Friday, August 20th, 2021, 11 women and 5 men entered Tarrant County Criminal Court 1 to a standing, nearly packed room. After eliminating dozens upon dozens of others, these folks were left to decide if Glenn Samuel McCurley, abducted, sexually assaulted, and murdered 17-year-old Western Hills High School student Carla Jan Walker in February of 1974, 47 years prior. 4 of these individuals were alternate jurors. They'd see and hear all evidence and witness testimony, but wouldn't help decide the verdict unless they were called upon to replace a regular juror. The jury was seated. Prosecutors, defense attorneys, and spectators, too, sat. The first day of the State of Texas versus Glenn Samuel McCurley began with opening statements. First up came Tarrant County Assistant Criminal District Attorney Emily Dixon, who was followed by court-appointed defense attorney Stephen Myers. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. Before the trial of Glenn Samuel McCurley began, of course, both the district attorney's office and the then-accused's defense team had much work to do as they prepared for the case to be brought before the jurors. When Carla's case came to the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office, ADAs Emily Dixon and Kim Davignon were assigned for the undertaking. Emily explained to us why the case hit their desk particularly.
There's specialized units that will handle certain types of cases. Kim Davignon and I make up the adult sexual assault unit. So we handle basically sexual assaults that are committed against adult victims, which is differentiated from, say, our special victims unit that handles crimes committed against children. So when this case came in, you know, we expressed interest in it because we knew the underlying felony was, well, kidnapping, but also sexual assault. That's kind of how we got assigned the case, why, you know, we got to be the ones to work on it. Especially with a case of this nature, the actual intake level involves just people taking a little bit of a closer look at it and talking about it with the detectives to make sure, you know, that they've kind of done everything, which of course, as we all saw on the trial, Detectives Wagner and Bennett are very detailed.
Emily was already familiar with Carla's case before she and Kim Davignon were assigned.
I was familiar with it. You know, I have an interest in cold cases, and that was kind of where the other intersection sort of came from, is right now, where a lot of the cold cases that end up with our office are coming from are in the form of sexual assault. There's a lot of a movement to, I mean, everyone's kind of heard probably in the media about this sort of national idea of ending a backlog of rape kits. Thankfully, in Tarrant County, there's not as much of a backlog issue. Our county has just done a fairly good job of keeping on top of that. We don't have those extreme examples that we hear about in the media, like in Detroit, where there's just thousands, you know, that were sitting on a shelf, or in Baltimore, same thing. But there is an element of, you know, making sure that things are getting uploaded to CODIS properly, and then making sure that those cases are being looked at properly, because so many people are repeat offenders in that way. So we found in the beginning, both Kim and I were pretty surprised when our new cases came in of how many people were getting CODIS hits and then the cases were getting filed with us. But it kind of surprised us, honestly. We knew that a certain amount would be, but not that there would be just this kind of fairly large amount. In part, that's because of this funding that has happened to support that testing. So they're catching up with some of those people. And so then, of course, like when I have that interest, so I was familiar with the case, you know, from being from the area and from, you know, listening to various true crime podcasts, including this one. So I was a little familiar with the backstory of the case itself. When it came in, it was pretty cool to actually then get to dig into the actual file, right? Because I sort of knew a little bit of the backstory, but obviously it's what's available publicly and also through people who kind of lived it is detailed, but it doesn't have as much of the actual investigation, you know, of what had already been looked at. And that was kind of where my interest especially was.
That case file, as Fort Worth Homicide Cold Case Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett explained in Part 1, is large. Voluminous, I believe, is how Detective Bennett described it. Needless to say, Assistant Criminal District Attorneys Davignon and Dixon had their work cut out for them. Detectives Wagner and Bennett had done the work that led to the identification and arrest of Glenn Samuel McCurley, but when the case hit the desk of the DA's office, an entirely new line of investigation began there. That's where Tarrant County District Attorney's Office investigator Chris LaChance came in. Emily Dixon gave us the rundown on Chris's role.
I mean, he, especially on this case, was instrumental, like a huge part of it for me and Kim. In this situation, when you're having to go through, you know, lists and lists and lists of just generations of officers and trying to really piece together which ones do we need, which ones are the most important for chain of custody, you know, which ones did which part of the investigation, and really piece all together where they all are. And then, of course, some of them, they're mentioned in that 1974 report and then never mentioned again. So he did a lot of work in, he is really good with like Excel spreadsheets and stuff. So he did a lot of work of just going through all of the reports, not the peripheral stuff, but just all the really core primary reports and notes, and making us just a whole spreadsheet of who all touched the case, divided up kind of almost decade by decade, and then tracking down those people. And of course, I mean, some of them had passed away. So that was part of what he had to update, was, you know, literally just who is physically able to talk to us. And then the ones who hadn't passed away, who were still available, tracking them down and helping us get a sense of what their role was, right? Because one of the hardest things with some of these reports is they kept very, very detailed notes. But of course, in 1974, many of them were handwritten. So there was just hours spent scrolling, you know, on a computer screen, a scanned copy of these handwritten notes, and trying to figure out, okay, is that still Detective Hudson's handwriting? Have we moved into Detective Bennett's? You know, that sort of thing. I would say that was the bulk of Chris's work as our investigator, was just tracking down all of these past investigators, figuring out if they were still around, if they were able to talk to us, what their role was. He did a lot of work in really piecing together the chain of custody. It was very documented, but it was kind of broken up, right? It wasn't as streamlined with a computer system like we have now. His day-to-day job is a lot of times just like the logistics of things, getting records for subpoenas served for us, you know, tracking people down for us and setting up our meetings or getting them to court or things like that. So it's a lot of traditional investigation mixed with logistics stuff for Kim and I.
ADAs Dixon and Davignon, on the other hand, had plenty of their own work to do. Since Carla Walker's murder case, at the time, was 46 years old, studying the case law from 1974 was among the many steps they took when preparing to bring McCurley before a grand jury. That experience, Emily told us, had its challenges and its unsettling moments.
A lot of reading, more so than in any other case, right? In a modern, for lack of a better word, modern case, we would spend a lot of time watching, you know, sometimes hours and hours of body camera footage or reading through phone dump reports and stuff like that. But we don't have that here. So it's a lot of just reading the investigative narrative. And I was just so shocked at just the sheer volume of it. But at a kind of more basic level, you know, the first thing you do with any case, and it was very true of this one, is in the state of Texas, anytime anyone's charged with any kind of felony, whether it's capital murder or just drugs, you have to take that case before the grand jury. So that's kind of your first step in preparation, because what the grand jury basically does is you present them the case, all of the evidence, and you also present them with the charges that you want on the indictment. And ultimately, what they have to decide is, you know, do we have enough evidence to go forward, as well as is there probable cause for the charges that we've presented, right? So when you're writing a charge, you know, for something from 1974, you have to follow 1974 law. So there was a lot of legal research that we had to do because, unfortunately, you know, the underlying offense for the count of capital murder involving sexual assault, now in 2021, in the state of Texas, we call sexual assault, sexual assault. That's the penal code title for it. But in 1974, it was referred to as aggravated rape. And it had some stuff in there that Kim likes to say, it just really makes her deeply uncomfortable talking about it. Because, you know, in 1974, you couldn't rape your wife. Marital rape didn't exist. There's a couple other things, like a woman had to, I am completely blanking on the exact wording, but there had to be something like earnest resistance. So, you know, this idea that you had to kind of fight back a little, that's not the legal definition of it, fighting back a little, but there was this element of you had to show that you kind of just didn't just freeze, right? So research into that type of law so that we could present that law, you know, before the grand jury and get a sign off on the indictment, that's really where your first preparation starts, because the indictment is ultimately what you're having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. So that first stage at grand jury is very important, because that's really where your preparation kind of starts of like, okay, if this is what I have, I'm taking stock of all of the evidence I have in this case. And then I get, you know, these charges presented and the grand jury says, yes, you know, you have a true bill, you have an indictment, go forward. Then that's what I have to prove in court.
On Wednesday, November 11th, 2020, a grand jury indicted Glenn Samuel McCurley for the murder of Carla Walker.
So from then on, once you have the indictment and you have it, you know, written the way it needs to be, and you know what your elements are, then the preparation just comes down to really a lot like how Detectives Wagner and Bennett described it when they reopen a case. You look at what you have and you take kind of an inventory of what physical evidence do I have? What does that do for me? How does it, I mean, this is a cheesy analogy, but how does it move the ball forward, right? You have to also obviously get evidence in through witnesses. So when you have a case this old, you kind of always have to think of it in terms of almost like, here's our primary way of getting something in. And then we also have maybe like a kind of backup plan, right? Like if we can't quite get the chain of custody, then what's our kind of alternative for getting this in to make sure that the jury is getting the full picture and they're getting everything that they're supposed to out of this? Beyond a reasonable doubt is a very high standard, and the jury is going to be very aware of that. So we try not to take anything for granted as far as like what we're proving. It's a focus on being as thorough as possible, which probably in court sometimes, if people are watching, it can translate to just being very repetitive. But the idea is, you know, we want to make sure that they understand that each and every one of those things we've proven in every possible way that we can.
McCurley's court-appointed team consisted of the decades experienced and clearly talented criminal defense attorney Stephen Myers, and the little less experienced, though quite skillful, defense attorney J. Eric Nichols. These guys are no schlubs. Far from it, actually. They're both exceptionally attentive to detail and thorough, not to mention Myers and Nichols previously worked as prosecutors. The former for the Lubbock County District Attorney's Office, and the latter for the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office. As the prosecution prepared their case against the then accused, Nichols and Myers were working hard to tip the scale of justice in their client's favor.
Hey, all you true crime fans, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morph.
And we'd like to invite you to listen to our podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered a variety of strange cases from murders to missing persons.
We dive into a variety of cases in both the U.S. and abroad.
Some of the cases are ones you may not have heard of, like the Pocatello babysitter murders or the canal murders.
Other cases we cover are some of the most historic in true crime, like the Tylenol murders and the Lindbergh kidnapping. We also dive into cases that are currently breaking thanks to DNA and forensic genealogy.
Sometimes you'll hear from people connected to the cases, like the interview we did with the brother-in-law of the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo.
There are close to 200 episodes of Criminology available to binge on right now, including full seasons covering the Zodiac Killer, the Golden State Killer, and Ted Bundy. And new episodes come out every Saturday night.
Subscribe to Criminology today, wherever you listen to your podcast.
Within days of his arrest and subsequent confession to police, and a few weeks before he was indicted for the abduction, sexual assault, and murder of 17-year-old Carla Walker, Glenn Samuel McCurley gave KRLD news reporter Andrew Greenstein a bullshit confession. While drinking beer in the parking lot of the Ridgely Brunswick Bowling Alley, McCurley told Greenstein he heard the screams of a damsel in distress coming from a nearby car. McCurley raced to this vehicle, he told the KRLD newsman, opened the car door, and saved this girl, Carla, from the beating her boyfriend was giving her. After getting Carla to the safety of his car, McCurley went on to say that he and Carla talked some, and when she finally calmed down, she thanked him for saving the day. She just gave me a hug. I gave her a kiss. I mistook her for something else, he was quoted as saying. I didn't mean to do it. Choke her to death. McCurley didn't mean to rape and choke her to death, he means. I'll bite my tongue here until we discuss the police confession video. The audio recording from this jailhouse interview, which took place downtown at the Lon Evans Correction Center, was one of the subjects of the pretrial hearings that took place. The defense wanted the KRLD confession thrown out, citing in motions to suppress that Glenn McCurley could have mistaken Greenstein's press badge for police identification. In a motion, they argued that McCurley wasn't read Miranda rights, and since Greenstein was acting as an agent of law enforcement, they said, it was a violation of the Texas Constitution. On Wednesday, June 16, 2021, Andrew Greenstein was called to testify in front of Judge Elizabeth Beach in a pretrial hearing. The reporter told the court that he called jailers and asked for an interview with McCurley. He asked a deputy to place a recording device on McCurley's side. Greenstein explained that deputy agreed and the interview was postponed for several minutes as the deputy traveled down an elevator, made his way through secure access, traveled back up the elevator, and placed the recording device in front of the prisoner. The defense's argument to suppress the KRLD recording was, basically, that law enforcement had procured this interview and that it's plausible McCurley thought that Greenstein was a cop. They argued that Greenstein's press badge could have been mistaken for police identification. Defense tried to get Greenstein into agreeing with this hypothetical notion, but the reporter more or less insisted that it was unlikely McCurley could have mistaken him for law enforcement. Greenstein's difficulty hearing McCurley through the partition, too, was further evidence that the prisoner might not have heard him announce himself as a KRLD news reporter, the defense said. Judge Beach denied the motion to exclude this jailhouse interview. During this day's proceedings, the defense also called into question the validity of the interrogation of Glenn Samuel McCurley on the day of his arrest. They argued their client did not understand his rights to remain silent and have counsel present, let alone waive them. When Detective Leah Wagner took the stand, a little more than 10 minutes of the 4-hour interrogation footage was played. McCurley can be seen continually avoiding detectives' questions concerning his Miranda rights after they were read to him in full. Both Detectives Wagner and Bennett repeatedly asked the man if he wanted to waive his rights and talk, but McCurley wouldn't answer. It's strikingly obvious he's only stalling here, biding his time until he concocts a story that at the very least makes him out to be less of a monster. Because of McCurley's failure to respond to the Miranda rights thing, the defense attempted to have the entire confession thrown out. McCurley's defense also suggested that the detectives coerced the confession by intentionally confusing this poor old man and promising him he would not get the death penalty. However, it was plainly seen at this pretrial hearing that neither Bennett nor Wagner performed anything remotely close to coercion, and in fact never told Glenn McCurley he wouldn't get the death penalty. Instead, when he said he'd get the chair or be hanged if he came clean, the detectives only told him that they weren't going to do that to him. And that's a true statement, since the last time the state of Texas fired up the electric chair was in 1964, and the last time a man swung from the gallows in the state was in 1923. Judge Beach cited the totality of the circumstances when she denied the defense's motion to exclude the confession. McCurley's inability to shut up during the interview was him waiving his rights, maybe not in his words, but in his actions. After this confession, a search warrant was issued for McCurley's Fort Worth home. The main subject of that warrant was an important piece of evidence in the Carla Walker case, the .22 Ruger pistol that he had used to bludgeon Rodney McCoy in the early morning hours of February 17, 1974. Likely, he also used this weapon to keep Carla in line as he beat, raped, and strangled her. The gun's magazine, if you'll remember, was found at the scene of the abduction. We didn't see any of the confession at pretrial hearings, but at trial, we did see Glenn Samuel McCurley deny for hours having used his Ruger on the attack against Carla and Rodney, and sticking to the story the gun was stolen back in 1974, just weeks before this very offense. Finally, anyway, in his confession, he admitted that he still had the .22 Ruger, and he told detectives where to find it in his house. It was tucked away in rafters behind some paneling in a storage room he'd built, the then-accused man told them. This pistol of his that became a sick trophy 46 years ago. Judge Beach denied the exclusion of the evidence found during that search warrant. Also taking the stand that day was the individual who identified the semen stains on Carla's bra, analyzed it for DNA, and later matched that unknown male 1 profile to Glenn Samuel McCurley, Mallory Pagenkopf from Serological Research Institute, or SERI. Othram Incorporated's John Trey Fonden, too, testified how he was able to test the DNA extract created at SERI and using genealogy was able to trace that profile to a set of brothers with the surname McCurley. The defense sought to have all the DNA evidence thrown out by technicalities. Not only was collecting trash from the curb of the McCurley home a violation of his private property, they argued, but since some involved in the DNA analysis were not accredited by the Texas Forensic Science Commission, the evidence was inadmissible by Texas law altogether. After hearing these testimonies and the testimony of University of North Texas professor and ex-FBI senior scientist, Dr. Bruce Bedoli, court adjourned when the defense asked for more time to further prepare their arguments. On Friday, July 9, 2021, a second pretrial hearing was held. In between the two proceedings, the defense filed a few more motions to suppress evidence. All their motions are incredibly interesting to read, and extremely well done considering what they had to work with, but it was the state's response that ultimately provided the best argument against suppression in the form of an analogy. You can hear Assistant Criminal District Attorney Kim Davignon's analogized response in our episode covering the second pretrial hearing released on July 11, 2021. I highly recommend going back and listening just for that. It's brilliant. We were in Tarrant County Criminal Court 1 that day for about 5 minutes. Judge Beach denied all the defense's motions to exclude evidence and testimony by Othram Incorporated and the Serological Research Institute. I wasn't able to make it to other pretrial hearings held in early August. At one of them, my friends and champions for Carla, Diane and Kathleen, told me the judge ruled that an audio tape of Rodney McCoy under police-observed hypnosis would be allowed at trial. Prosecutors agreed not to talk about the infamous green vest or the car that Rodney recalled at that session. You can go back and listen to our original Carla Walker series for more information on that. Also, they agreed Rodney McCoy would not be asked to identify Glenn McCurley. Again, I was not at these later hearings, but I do have the motions to suppress filed by McCurley's defense. Most notably on them, perhaps, was their attempt to prevent the state from calling an expert witness to give their opinions on Carla Walker's autopsy report. Dr. Felix Quotes, the Tarrant County medical examiner who performed the autopsy, had long since died, and the defense wanted no one to give their opinion at trial on A. the overall results, B. the cause of death, and C. evidence of sexual assault or contact. The defense lost on this one too, and Tarrant County Deputy Medical Examiner Dr. Tasha Greenberg would be allowed to testify at trial. But when the time came, it didn't matter. On Thursday, August 19, 2021, the process to select a jury for the state of Texas versus Glenn Samuel McCurley began. The word selection, perhaps, isn't the right one, as a woman named Nicole, juror number 6 at the Carla Walker trial, explained to us.
So I've been called for jury summons in the past, never in Tarrant County. I've been living in Tarrant County for about 3 years. And in the past, I was either a student or I had a small child or I had a reason which would eliminate me from being selected. And so this is actually the first time that I'd ever been available to actually serve on the jury. The place we were to arrive to, there was a massive amount of people in the lobby. Eventually, they came around and made sure we had filled out our COVID little section and all that again. So they start lining us up, and all of a sudden I realize, okay, all of these people are for the same jury summons. And there were 100 of us, and I was like, wow, well, this is kind of interesting. I've never been called to a summons with that many people before.
Unfortunately, the call's audio here becomes unusable. Nicole goes on to say that the potential jurors were called into a large courtroom, where Judge Elizabeth Beach spoke to them about the selection process. The defense spoke next about which case the potential jurors were there for, the Carla Walker case, and
kind of giving, versing us on what the laws were from 1974 versus what the laws are today and how those, some of those laws have changed. And so when we try this person, we would need to try them based on the laws of 1974. And so they did a really good job of kind of educating us at the same time asking us questions. They would kind of ask an open-ended question, and if you had an answer for that, you could raise your hand.
When they came back from lunch, the defense spoke for another hour and a half. They presented more questions to the jurors summoned there, some the same as they had before, and others on a ranked scale. Nicole described this as 1 strongly disagree to 5 strongly agree.
During that process of asking questions, they figure out who's not going to follow the law, who says, I can't try an 87-year-old man for anything.
At around 4 p.m., a break was called. None of the 100 or so potential jurors had been dismissed yet. 4 to 5 folks were questioned separately before the entire group was called back in, Nicole said. When it was all said and done, after the state eliminated the folks they thought weren't jury material for this case, and the defense did the same, 16 people remained, 12 jurors and 4 alternate jurors. Nicole was one of the 12.
I had never heard of this cold case, so I think, you know, that probably has something to do with why I ended up getting selected.
The trial began the following day, on Friday, August 20th, 2021, at 8:30 a.m. For a detailed account of the day's proceedings, please refer back to our episode released on August 22nd, 2021. Since I wasn't able to go into the second day of trial in too much detail, the day of the confession video, we're going to concentrate mostly on that. Having said that, before moving on to day 2, it is important, perhaps, to quickly summarize day 1. After the state and the defense gave opening statements, Rodney McCoy, Carla's boyfriend and the second victim in this story, took the stand. Rodney did an incredible job of bringing Carla to life through good memories, which included his recollections of the evening prior to Carla's abduction. Then, of course, he recalled the terrifying and tragic events that took place just after the day turned to Sunday, February 17, 1974. Was Carla married? Was prosecutor Emily Dixon's last question to Rodney.
So one of the things we had to prove, and I don't know if many people caught it, but one of the things we had to ask was Carla married? It was Rodney that said, no, she wasn't married. We have to prove that, right? Because that's an element of, I mean, 1974 of aggravated rape was this person married to the defendant? Because if they were, it doesn't count. Thankfully, it's not a thing anymore, but it's kind of crazy to think like, you know, 1974, that's recent enough that, you know, all of these people are still here. It's like a lifetime ago, not quite a lifetime ago. It's recent. And yet, you know, something we kind of take for granted was legal back then.
To provide a narrative of the events that took place immediately after Carla's body was found on Wednesday, February 20th, 1974, and to account for the evidence and the chain of custody of that evidence, the state also called to the stand Daryl Thompson, the Fort Worth police officer who discovered Carla's body in the concrete cattle crossing culvert. Also called was Jack Bolton, a Fort Worth police crime scene investigator in 1974, who used his new 8mm Kodak movie camera to preserve the scene on film and in color, color filming being a relatively new method for the department at the time. This footage was played in court after the state introduced it, and it was allowed into evidence. The state also introduced several photographs of Carla's body in the culvert from every possible angle. The film and the images were terribly shocking, grisly, and heartbreaking, and resulted in sobbing family members and friends. Longtime Fort Worth police officer and Major Cases Unit Detective James Bennett also sat on the witness stand that day. He was at the culvert that cold February late afternoon in 1974 at the autopsy and was assigned to assist the lead detective on the case, George Hudson. Allowed into evidence was a stock photo of a .22 caliber Ruger pistol, and James Bennett testified about how they determined it was this particular model. Autopsy photos, too, were admitted into evidence. Though not necessarily as gruesome as the photos and film taken at the scene where Carla Walker's body was found, they were nearly as disturbing. Former policeman James Bennett, by the way, is no relation to current Fort Worth homicide cold case detective Jeff Bennett. Jim Minter took the stand next. In 1974, Minter was a Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator. He was called to the culvert just west of Benbrook Lake immediately upon the discovery of Carla's body and also attended her autopsy. Minter spoke of the scene, the evidence collected there, the procedures at the autopsy, and answered questions on cross-examination by the defense, mostly about a Tennessee man who confessed in 1978, Jimmy Dean Sasser. Detective Leah Wagner was the final witness on the first day of testimony. She described for the court how she and Detective Bennett got started working the case in 2019 and how it progressed, ultimately leading to the arrest of the defendant, Glenn Samuel McCurley. You can hear that in Detective Wagner's own words and voice, along with Detective Bennett's in our last episode, Part 1 of Justice for Carla. Introduced into evidence during Wagner's testimony was the actual physical evidence itself. Carla's dress and bra, her underwear, her pantyhose found discarded not far from her body, and the .22 Ruger pistol magazine that was left at the scene of the abduction. Also introduced and admitted was an audio recording the detectives took when they approached Glenn McCurley for a cheek swab to test the DNA straight from the source and compare it to the unknown male 1 profile at Serological Research Institute. The profile had already been compared to trash collected at the curb of the man's home and matched. McCurley does end up giving Wagner and Bennett a voluntary swab, as we all know at this point. But what is most interesting about the audio recording isn't the man's eventual cooperation in this matter. Rather, it's information he gives and language he uses while speaking with detectives. Concerning the pistol that led detectives to him back in 1974, McCurley said that one of his clips went bad on it. That line to me is particularly interesting, since it is my belief he intended to kill Rodney McCoy during the kidnapping of Carla Walker, but because he'd bludgeoned the 18-year-old over the head with the pistol, presumably his attempts at firing it directly into Rodney's face and head failed. The magazine, I mean, came loose during the beating. He told Detectives Wagner and Bennett the same story he'd told Fort Worth Detectives Hudson, Sinclair, and Wood in 1974, that this Ruger had been stolen weeks prior to Carla's abduction and murder. McCurley told Detectives Wagner and Bennett that he didn't know if the cops ever recovered this stolen gun, but he did remember them questioning him about it concerning, quote, the little girl that got captured, end quote. Captured is an incredibly interesting word to use, damning in my opinion, because I cannot imagine anyone referring to the victim of an abduction as such. Anyone, that is, except a predator. Detective Leah Wagner's testimony ended after some grilling by the defense on cross-examination. Court was put on recess until Monday, and we're going to jump right into McCurley's confession video, which was played during Detective Jeff Bennett's testimony on that second day of trial. It took place on Monday, August 23rd, 2021. Because last episode we had Serological Research Institute's Mallory Pagenkopf and Authorm Incorporated's David Middleman describe for listeners their laboratory's roles in the investigation of Carla Walker's murder, we're going to fast forward through Mallory and John Fonden's testimonies here. Fort Worth Homicide Cold Case Detective Jeff Bennett took the stand after these witnesses, and the court heard his recollections of the investigation, which you also heard on Part 1. After that, the state introduced Glenn McCurley's confession interview video to the court. The interview began not long after the man was taken into custody. When the video starts, McCurley is shown sitting in a small interview room, waiting several minutes for Detectives Wagner and Bennett to arrive. After walking into the room, Wagner slides a photograph of Carla Walker over to him.
I've never seen her, never met her, I've never talked to her, I wouldn't know her if she was standing beside him.
Detective Wagner reads McCurley his rights, and both she and Detective Bennett can be heard throughout the video, leading up to his confession, repeatedly asking if he understands and is willing to waive those rights and talk. McCurley continually avoids answering those questions, other than saying, I guess, at one point. He never once, however, refuses to talk, and in fact, never shuts the hell up. At times, he's soft-spoken, and at other times, he raises his voice, visibly and audibly becoming upset.
I haven't killed anybody, like I told you the other day. I'm 77 years old, and I'm not into that kind of stuff.
Eventually, at 2:15 p.m. on Monday, September 21st, 2020, Glenn Samuel McCurley confessed after detectives explained to him that they had the evidence that proved he raped and killed Carla, and because he had made the mistake of leaving a witness alive, Carla's boyfriend, Rodney McCoy. As Glenn Samuel McCurley sobs and confesses, he plays a little with his shirt, and a couple times he can be seen coming out of his crying fit at the snap of a finger, or rather a question he doesn't like. He had been driving around and drinking whiskey and beer since daylight, McCurley told Detectives Wagner and Bennett, and at some point parked in the parking lot of the Ridgely Brunswick bowling alley. Not long after that, he heard the screams of a damsel in distress, he says. Heroically, McCurley made it sound, he saved this little girl from a car where she was being roughed up by her boyfriend. He was a big guy, McCurley said, and he had this little girl up against the car door, quote, jerking her around and this and that kind of stuff. End quote. He opened the door to help her out, McCurley told detectives. He put her in his car, McCurley said, and got her calmed down. They talked about some things, he went on, and she thanked and hugged him for saving the day. Then, he told detectives, they had sex.
Well, she just was thankful that I got her away from him. That's what she said. I took advantage of her, I guess. I choked her to death, I guess, and then I didn't beat her up and all that kind of crap. I'm guilty.
Guilty of what?
I guess.
You guilty of raping her and killing her?
I guess.
He'd later say he was scared Carla would tell his wife they had sex. In fact, McCurley continually denied raping Carla, even when he was confronted by detectives telling him they had evidence he did. Much of the language and denial in this videoed interview, even after McCurley confessed, says a lot about the man, and perhaps provides clues that Carla Walker might not be his only victim. The way in which Carla's abduction was perpetrated certainly suggests that Glenn Samuel McCurley knew what he was doing. It seems like a sophisticated, violent crime. Tarrant County Assistant Criminal District Attorney Emily Dixon and I spoke a little about that.
Especially for someone who claimed he was drunk. I mean, it is fairly sophisticated. It's pretty brazen. I would say normally, I would think most people who were going to try and snatch someone would not go for someone who's with someone else. Whether or not they're, you know, just two teenagers, it's very bold to go and do that. And it's also bold to walk up to someone who is inside a car, right? I mean, if you're going to walk up behind someone on a street that's dark, or, you know, not very well lit, whatever, like, but it's also, you're just adding another variable on top of it, right? And so that's also very brazen.
In his recorded confession at a Fort Worth police station, Glenn McCurley bounces back and forth. Even after he kind of admits to Carla's murder, admits to choking her, he tells detectives at one point that she was still alive after he choked her, standing up against the car at one point, and when he left her next to some bushes against a building at another point. McCurley said Rodney drove out of the parking lot shortly after he saved Carla from him. This is sheer conjecture, but perhaps McCurley was getting his victims mixed up. But we'll explore that more in an upcoming episode. Still, the language McCurley uses naturally leads the mind to wonder that question, and at the very least, even if somehow Carla Walker is this monster's only victim, which I personally doubt, the language provides a glimpse into the man's predatory mind. The quote I mentioned earlier from the audio interview, made when detectives visited the McCurley home to obtain a cheek swab for DNA comparison, seems telling. When recalling being taken to the station for questioning in 1974, McCurley called Carla the little girl that got captured. The little girl, by the way, who was 4 feet 11 inches tall and not even 100 pounds, to McCurley's 6 feet 3 inches tall and 250-ish pounds, captured. ADA Emily Dixon also told me about a certain word the man can be heard using in his videoed interview.
There were certain things that really stuck out to me about his interview the first time I watched it that I thought were, you know, very disturbing and were very powerful for our case, but were also just overall very disturbing. And one of those things was, at one point he uses the phrase when they're talking about this idea that maybe the sex, he's saying that maybe the sex is consensual, and Detective Wagner is like, that doesn't make any sense. Here are all these reasons why. And he's describing that, you know, well, she was compliant. And that word compliant is just so really disturbing to me because it's so accurate probably, but not in the way he's trying to make it, right? I mean, she's being held at gunpoint. So to some extent, she's compliant because she has a gun pulled on her and she's being taken away from the car. I mean, when we think about Rodney's wording of what he experienced, he describes this very graphic scene of there's blood pouring down into his eyes. I mean, that's what she's seeing as she's being led away. So for him to say that, well, she was compliant, well, you know, I think at one point he also says something like, well, I mean, I didn't hit her, which we've all seen the photos at this point. We know that's not true. But even if it was true, like, that's not consensual. That is very much not consensual. And he, in that moment, he seemed to truly believe that was okay. That, well, I mean, she was compliant. So what's your problem with this, right? And I think that the idea that he was saying, well, I was scared that she would tell on me is kind of, I've always found that kind of interesting because he never really addresses Detective Wagner's point about like, well, hey, if this is consensual, who cares if she tells people, right? I mean, worst case scenario, she's telling people in her circle that she had consensual sex with some random guy. Like, why is that a concern? But more than that, I think it really says a lot that he was concerned that she would report it, right? And when we think about the time frame, one of the things that I kind of think about is, well, was he concerned that maybe people would believe her if she reported it? And it makes me wonder, are there people that he had maybe done that to, not murder, but just had been sexually violent to, that hadn't reported it? Or who, if they reported it, they weren't believed, right? People who were in a vulnerable population or just vulnerable people who, women back then who were not believed because of their status in life or whatever. That's coming from the perspective of someone who, like I said, Kim and I both prosecute sex crimes. And so many of these people are serial offenders.
Throughout the confession, Glenn McCurley continually denied having his .22 Ruger that night. He kept the gun in his pickup truck, McCurley said, and he'd been driving his car that night. But Detectives Wagner and Bennett never budged, and not long after confronting McCurley with the fact they knew the injuries to Rodney McCoy's head and face were the result of a pistol whipping, he finally gave in. At 3:45 p.m. that day, he told detectives it was in the rafters behind paneling in a storage room he built in his house. It was wrapped in a towel, the color of which he couldn't say. We later saw that it was white. Since he wouldn't sign a consent form allowing detectives to retrieve the Ruger, Glenn McCurley's trophy from that terrible night, they'd later get a search warrant and recover the weapon. This entire interview, the way Detectives Wagner and Bennett handled it, was nothing short of riveting. Far more interesting than any interview I've seen on television crime dramas. Emily Dixon, too, was impressed.
I thought it was fascinating because it was almost like you could really see kind of how they responded. You know, you could almost see strategy between the two of them. Like they worked seamlessly sort of as a team in that way.
Borrowing a quote from someone else who told detectives much the same thing, Wagner and Bennett humanized this process. But the modest detectives called McCurley's interview business as usual.
For us, I guess, because it was business as usual, it didn't seem that spectacular to us. Like, we were just so happy to get a confession that the whole process just flew by us, and it was just kind of like, okay, you know,
we did what we do.
Yeah. And so for you guys to actually compliment us on that, it's like, wow, we didn't realize we did anything that special.
Right, right. We felt like after him carrying this for 46 years, we were hoping that appealing to his conscience or his human side was going to be productive. We were going to be firm and resolute in the interview. You know, we could see throughout the interview, three steps forward, two steps back, three steps forward, two steps back. We kept making progress, but we were having to inch our way along, but we saw that what we were doing was working.
And we also know that, you know, there's no cookie cutter method because everybody's different. And so how we dealt with him would be different than somebody that was probably much younger and more arrogant. So we knew that, you know, using a little bit more of a gentler approach was going to be better with him. And also, I mean, he's old, you know, we also didn't, you know, despite the fact that he committed this horrific crime, we also didn't want to be seen on there, you know, waylaying some old man. You know, we wanted to show that, you know, we're doing our job and we're doing what we have to, but that doesn't mean we have to be the bad guys while doing it.
And having aggressive tactics with him did not seem like the right approach.
When we had seen him and spoken with him prior to this at his home, we also kind of got a feel for him at
Absolutely.
That point. So that also helped us with deciding how to deal with him in the actual in-custody interview.
I haven't talked much about the defense's cross-examination of witnesses in this episode, and I've got to tell you, there wasn't a lot the entire trial, but it seems important to address here. When questioning Detective Jeff Bennett, the defense suggested very strongly that Glenn McCurley's confession was the result of he and Detective Leah Wagner's coercive approach. They pushed an ailing, confused 77-year-old man into confessing was essentially the point the defense tried to make. The video, however, starkly contrasts that notion.
Both Kim and I mean, we've watched it so many times, like 6 or 7 times probably each, just over the course of preparing, right? Because it's very long, and so there's a lot of detail, and, you know, you go back and are like, well, did he say it then, or did he say it during the Buckle interview? And so we each watched it, you know, so many times, and we would joke with each other about how every time right before he finally confessed, there was almost this moment of suspense where you're like, he's going to confess still, right? You know, like, we know he's going to, but we still kind of like would hold our breath, and because it kind of takes so long to get there. Overall, though, I would say my perspective on it, the first time I watched it, you know, just all the way through, was he was very good at sort of playing the, you know, I don't understand this stuff. I'm just kind of a simple old man. But I kind of felt like that wasn't true, that he was just very good at playing that part. And I think it's really highlighted in the, just in the waiver section where they're asking him about waiving his rights. When you really watch it and you really pay attention to kind of what it is he's saying in response to the detective, it's pretty clear he's just avoiding the question altogether. It's not that he doesn't understand. That theme of doing that seemed to be at play when it was to his advantage, right? He would not directly answer a question, but he would walk right up to the line and then kind of change the subject, right? They ask him repeatedly, okay, are you sure that you want to talk with us? And he wouldn't say yes. He wouldn't say no. He'd just start wanting to talk about, you know, his story with the gun. Well, I mean, that's still talking. He clearly showed he understands what they're saying to him, but he's kind of wanting to drive the bus to some extent, right? They did a really good job of responding to that and kind of, you know, really not letting him get away with it, but also still keeping the interview pretty laid back, pretty low key, because they knew that was really the best way to get any information out of him.
Detectives are never physically or verbally abusive, and constantly trying to cater to the man's diabetic needs by offering cokes and snacks.
You know, you can live in a world every day and think that, you know, we're the bad guys and that, you know, we squeezed or coerced a false confession out of him. But when you watch that video, there's no way that anybody could say that what he said was a false confession.
Yeah. The way we treated him with even as horrific of a crime as he committed, the amount of grace and compassion that we expressed to him, nobody could confuse that with coercing.
So if there was any doubt at that point from his family, that doubt would have gone away. And I think that he knew that at that point. And that's the only reason he showed emotion, because he knew the jig was up.
What Wagner says at the end there, she and Bennett are far from the only individuals to come away with that impression. Glenn Samuel McCurley's tears, his sobbing, weren't the result of remorse for what he'd done to Carla. Rather, it was getting caught that had him choked up. Anyway, here's the rest of the detective's thoughts on that.
He had a couple of different sets of responses. The first time he cried, we did not feel like that was genuine remorse, especially when he dried it up immediately when he didn't like one of the questions that followed him and that expression of remorse, if you will. I mean, he turned on a dime, no tears, no whimpering, and got very aggressive back with us. So it didn't feel like that one was genuine, but later on when he confessed and he was truly sobbing, felt like that was genuine emotion. What all that emotion was that was going on inside of him, we'll never know. But it certainly appeared to be genuine to us at that point.
We also felt like he was giving just enough, but that he wasn't necessarily truly sorry.
Right. Yes.
Like
he was, because he was still holding on to the gun at that point. So he was still lying to us. So you don't have genuine remorse until you're giving it all up. So we were frustrated at that point, even when we saw what we thought was genuine remorse, we knew he was still being deceptive.
So it was definitely a push and pull. We pushed, he pulled, he pulled, we pushed. And you know, we did that little tango back and forth for a while.
That's why it took almost 4 hours.
And we actually probably felt like he was more sorry that he got caught than sorry about doing it.
Absolutely.
No, at the end of the day, he was more sorry that he got caught than actually doing it.
No two ways about it.
Jeff was in there during the interview when they played that. And I was told that that's really the only time that he cried. And my belief on that is it's because his family reacted at that point. His wife cried. His son cried. That's the only time he actually showed emotion during the trial. But I think it was in response to his family, not the actual content. Because at that point, there was no denying by his family that he actually confessed.
Or juror number 6 also caught McCurley sobbing, but snapping immediately out of it and getting defensive when another question was asked.
It was very obvious that it wasn't sincere at all.
Carla Walker's brother Jim and sister Cindy told me much of the same thing, and we'll hear from them both on Part 3, next episode. Day 2 of the trial ended with Detective Bennett's testimony. The following morning, on Tuesday, August 24th, 2021, as most of y'all listening already know, Glenn Samuel McCurley changed his plea from not guilty to guilty. That, how the trial was going to progress had the plea not changed, and how the outcome impacted those closest to Carla Jan Walker, is coming up on the next episode of Gone Cold. After 47 years, nearly 5 decades, Carla Walker's murder is solved. But the city of Fort Worth still has nearly 1,000 cold cases dating back to 1959. If you have any information about any unsolved case in the city of Fort Worth, please contact the Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Or you can email detectives at coldcase@fortworthpd.com. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of victims, or even help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company, like Ancestry or 23andMe, for example, to their database. Your DNA profile will only be used there for law enforcement investigations, nothing else. If you have not tested with one of these consumer sources, but would like to help law enforcement identify violent criminals and Jane or John Does, you can go to connect.dnasolves.com to order a swab kit directly from them for only $15. At dnasolves.com too, you can see some of the other cases Othram has worked on or is currently working on, and even be a part of solving a cold case by donating a little cash to one or maybe all of the law enforcement cases there that need help funding. From here on out, we'll be donating a good chunk of the proceeds we make on Patreon to DNASolves.com and another really good cause that I can't mention yet. In the episode after next, we'll be getting into the importance of the technologies Othram uses and the many ways you can help in a little more depth. We'll provide links to DNASolves.com and the Fort Worth Cold Case Unit in this episode's show notes. We'd like to thank Tarrant County Assistant Criminal District Attorney Emily Dixon, Fort Worth Homicide Cold Case Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett, and Juror Number 6, Nicole, for their contributions to this episode. Thank you, too, to Cindy, Jim, and Rodney. We love y'all. Thanks to Robbie P. Sorry I forgot to shout you out last time, man. Kathy O., Chris M., Kim S., Kathleen B., Diane K., Jonathan H., Cindy VY, Kathy K., Renee ML., Buzz and Melinda S., Cindy DC, Jim Minter, Mary K., Rose M., D. Underwood, and all Carla's friends and classmates who have kept her memory alive and sought justice for her. Thanks, y'all are the best. And of course, thank you all for listening and for keeping Carla's case alive. As always, you can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. For all you current patrons, I'll get that Tourniquet Killer Part 4 episode out soon. I'm so sorry about the wait. It's been a wild and busy month, and I apologize. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. We appreciate y'all's support beyond words. Thanks for listening, y'all.